Welcome to the Investing in Real Estate podcast with Clayton Morris. This is the show where we focus on buy and hold real estate. Why do we do it? We do it for the purposes of creating passive income and legacy wealth for you and your family. If you're interested in finding your freedom number, come over to our website at morrisinvest.com/freedom and download your free financial freedom cheat sheet today. Hey, everybody, and welcome into today's show. I'm extremely excited to talk about raising money today on the show. I think if there's one common question I get from people on a regular basis, it's how can I get more money to buy more real estate and do more deals? Well, you're in luck because my guest today is Victor Menashe. He is a trusted real estate investment expert, a developer, and author of the brand new book called Magnetic Capital, How to Raise All the Money You Need for Any Worthy Venture. Victor has raised more than $300 million for ventures, corporate buyouts, and real estate projects all across North America. He's also teaching others how to raise capital using five elements of raising money in his new book. Victor, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much. So what part of the world do you live in?
I live in Ottawa, Canada.
Canada. So yes. We're at springtime here in the States. How is it up there? Is it still snowing?
You know, we're actually just dealing with very high flood waters. Had a tremendous amount of rain, and so very high water. It's been all over the news here in Canada, probably even parts of the States as well.
Yeah, well, we've had nonstop rain down here as well. So, well, good, good. Well, thanks so much for joining us, and I can't wait to talk about the five elements of raising money, and we'll dive into them, some of those specifics. How did you come into this way of thinking, this way of investing, going after money? How did this become your sort of cross to bear?
Well, I really started raising money in the technology world. You know, I used to be a microprocessor designer and rose through the ranks of both public and private companies, and then started raising money for startups. And in the process, I discovered that it was really difficult at times and much easier at other times. And it was in that process that I recognized that there was a formula. There was a point in time when it was effortless. There were some ingredients that were present, and when it was really hard, those certain ingredients were missing. And that's how I kind of developed this formula, made it, it's almost paint by numbers. And when you start to think of it that way, it really becomes quite obvious. When you really are hitting on all of the elements, raising money is actually quite easy.
Do you think back to your first deal? Do you ever think back to your first time trying to raise money?
Oh yeah, I did it all wrong. It was crazy.
Was it scary? tell me about it.
Well, so the very first big capital raise that I did, and I had done some smaller ones, but the very first big one that I did was to go actually and acquire a division out of IBM. And I write about it a little bit in the book. I didn't go in all the details, but I wrote about it in the book. And we're really looking at that time to raise almost, you know, $250 million. And I'd never raised that kind of money before. So I started out going after venture capital because that's what I knew. And I had raised money with venture capital and done it successfully. But what I didn't have, you know, when you're trying to raise that amount of money, venture capitalists are basically looking to write a check of maybe 10, 15, maybe $25 million at a time. And how are you going to put together $250 million? You're going to get 10 of these guys? It doesn't make any sense. But that's where I started. And you know, little did I know that I needed to get one person to write a single check. And, you know, I spent probably a month, maybe 6 weeks fumbling around in the dark. But it actually turned out to be a good experience because as I was going to pitch to all of these venture capitalists, I was getting very good feedback from people who could never really fund the project, but they were giving me good feedback, preparing me for ultimately when I did go to, you know, give the pitch to some of the private equity firms that we actually did ultimately end up funding the project with.
Do you remember some of that advice? Did any, if you had to pick one, two, or three bits of advice that came from those individuals, does any of it stand out to you today?
Absolutely. You know, one of the senior partners at a firm out of Boston was very focused on maintaining my negotiating leverage. He said, Victor, you have no negotiating leverage if you present yourself this way. And so he was very focused on that aspect. So, you know, you get different things from different presentations. But progressively over the course of time doing a bunch of these, I actually got better and better. So when it came time to actually giving the pitch, you know, down in Manhattan, it actually went quite well. The very first pitch that we did was a Credit Suisse versus Boston. And in an hour, they said, yeah, we'll be there for you. And we were blown away. So, you know, that practice was essential.
When you look at real estate, when you look at raising money for microchips or whatever it happens to be, do you see, are they basically the same or are there some stark differences?
I think they're almost identical. They really are. And, you know, we get into it when we talk about what the five elements are. It'll be obvious and it's kind of intuitive. It almost sounds so simple when after you hear it, you're going to go, that's so obvious. And yet most people don't get it if you haven't seen it before.
Now, obviously, this show is geared around real estate investing. We have a lot of investors who, you know, maybe own 5, 6, 7 properties, want to turn that into 30 or 40 or 50.
Sure.
And, you know, moving towards they own maybe their first batch of them free and clear, but then they want to accelerate that and take things to the next level. Do you see that raising private money is the best way to go?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. And, you know, when you're doing smaller projects, especially if you're starting out, you can often do projects where you're maybe working with one or two investors and you don't have to go through all of the, you know, process of doing a syndication like you would if you're trying to do a larger development, which is a whole other layer of complexity. So if you're just starting out, get comfortable with the basic principles. You've got a lot more latitude in terms of how you negotiate. If you're trying to do something on a larger scale where you've got to put together, you know, an entire private placement memorandum where you've got to treat all of the investors the same, that ties your hands in some ways. So definitely start out small, get really good at what you're doing, and then figure out how to bump up to the next level.
You talked about some of the basic structuring, and I don't know if those are in your five elements or not, but I wanted to sort of lay or paint a foundation. I think some of the hardest things for people to do is they hear certain steps, but there was one big gaping hole, and it really keeps people from getting off the couch and taking action. So foundationally, we're putting this together, we're getting started for the first time. Are there some foundational elements we need to do in order to start raising money before we dive into the five elements?
I think the first one is it's a mindset issue. You know, when I talk to a lot of rookie investors, they say, I'm uncomfortable asking for money. So I'm really uncomfortable raising capital because I don't want to ask for money. So my response to that is, great, don't ask for money, because I never ask for money. What I do is I offer people the opportunity to collaborate on a project. In fact, I'm not being selfish in any way. I'm actually being generous. If I have a compelling opportunity, I would actually be disloyal to people that I have a strong relationship with if I didn't offer it to them. And so when you take that perspective, it really flips it around 180 degrees. You're really giving someone an opportunity as opposed to asking for money. And when you do that, it takes an awful lot of the pressure off.
That's great. So to date, how much you've raised over $300 million. What's a typical deal maybe for someone to get started with? Is there a rule of thumb? Don't go for 500 million, go for a million, go for 500,000. Is there a rule of thumb or just kind of what you need to get to use is what you go after?
If I'm a believer in something called the rule of three, which means that if you're looking to scale up, if you're looking to grow, and maybe you've done a couple of single family homes, maybe the next thing for you to do is to do some triplexes. And then after that, maybe go to a 9 or 10 unit building. And you'd be looking to scale up by roughly a factor of three each time. Now, when you're in the 1 to 3, you're still in the residential underwriting rules world. Residential means that the banks, when they look at you, assume that you're going to be repaying the loan primarily out of your employment income. Whereas if you go into 5 and above, you're in the world of commercial, you're going to have a much higher ceiling in terms of your borrowing ability. You've heard about people getting fannied and freddied out. Well, what that means is the lender is basically going to cap you. They say, okay, you've got 10 doors now. That's all. You're cut off. You're not going to get any more.
Right.
So, you know, as the quicker you can transition from the world of residential underwriting to the world of commercial underwriting, that unlocks the ceiling for you.
That's fascinating. That's great to know. So let's dive in now, if you don't mind, to some of the elements. And of course, we're going to have links to everything we talk about here in the show notes page so people can order your book and dive even deeper with some of the mechanics here. But let's start with element number one.
Element number one is very fundamental, and it starts with relationship. If you think about maybe it might be friends and family. Are they going to part with tens or hundreds of thousands of their hard-earned savings with someone they don't have a relationship with? Most people will not. So it really starts with relationship, and you make relationship the foundation. It's more important that you develop a solid relationship than you do business together. So it means you may have to develop several relationships, And they, maybe not all of them turn into, you know, business collaborations, but it really starts with relationship.
Now, do you recommend starting with friends and family, or is it something you recommend, you know, maybe going out to local real estate meetings and developing relationships there? Because for some people, it can be a little awkward question. You know, it can be a little hard for some people.
Absolutely. You know, the first, if you're dealing with someone who's never invested with real estate before, and you're trying to convince them to invest in real estate, you're trying to take them maybe 180 degrees from where they are into investing into a different asset class. You know, and that's a heavy lift. Mm-hmm. I'd rather see you take someone who has already got experience investing in real estate. Maybe they own some property, investment property right now. They look at what you're doing. They have confidence in you. And now all you're doing is you're saying, well, look a little bit here to the left. And now you're just, you know, redirecting them maybe 15 degrees rather than 180 degrees and getting them to focus on your project as opposed to something else. That's a much easier lift. And so don't try and do anything. I think the number one thing, if there was any message for your listeners to take away, is don't force it. Whatever you do, when you're working with investors, it's got to feel like a natural fit. And when it feels natural, it'll feel effortless. And if there's any part of it that feels forced, it's probably not going to work.
So true. It's so true in every facet of sales, business. You know, when we work with new investors who are buying properties through us, if they're nervous at all, if there's hesitation, I'd rather just say, I don't think this is a good fit for you. You know, this is not forcing it, trying to chase people never works. It's the same in relationships, right? Trying to go after the date and get the girl or, you know, get the guy. It's
exactly
when you're chasing, and no one likes to chase anyone, and no one likes to be chased. So I think that's a good rule for finding money as well. Today's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter.com. Now, I'm serious, and I'm wearing my business suit here for a little bit, because for all you people out there who are in business, whether you're a sole proprietor or you're in HR and you have to do the hiring, well, you have the most important job in the business, because this company is one of the greatest inventions in the past several years, ZipRecruiter.com. In fact, at Morris Invest, we're in the process of hiring a couple of people right now, some of our client relations specialists and some other members of our team. But we're not just going to throw out ads on Craigslist and get some terrible candidate for the job. It's ridiculous. So with ZipRecruiter.com, that's what we're going to use. You can post to 200-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. So what you can do is then you can screen screen the potential employee. You can rate them, and then you can hire the right candidate very, very fast. So your company, you know, it's made up of people, and it's good, right? A right employee can send your company to the roof, but the wrong hire, as you probably already know, can bring it down to the ground. So that's why it's important that when the time comes, and it's hard, I know, but when you're short on staff, you don't want to look for staff. So you want to look for a replacement, but ZipRecruiter makes it so easy. So you search for a job, but you can also post a job. It's awesome. Post one job to ZipRecruiter.com, and it goes to more than 200 different job boards. And they've also expanded, of course, to Twitter and Facebook. So the idea is you want to get that job listing in front of as many people as you can, as quickly as possible and as widely as possible. There are millions of companies, some of them the biggest companies in the world, using ZipRecruiter. And our little company is using it as well. You can post, watch the candidates roll in. No more juggling emails, no more phone calls. That's the best part about it. You get to go through and see who the best candidates are, and you're not being flooded with emails from different people. So find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/investing. ZipRecruiter.com/investing. One more time, do it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/investing. Thanks, ZipRecruiter, for your support of the Investing in Real Estate podcast.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you used human relationships as a great example. I think the analogy works, because if you think about, you know, maybe, two people go out on a first date, and a long way down the road, they may decide to start a family. There's a whole bunch of steps in between. But if you skip any of those steps, you go from a natural relationship progression to creepy in a heartbeat.
Right.
Right? And how many times do we witness people go to creepy in business? It happens all the time.
No, it's so true. And there's a fine line. I mean, it really happens quickly. Let's talk about the second element of raising money.
The second element is trust. And this is a psychological contract. And it's way more than just, is this an honest person that I'm dealing with? Or are you an honest person as a, let's say, the sponsor of a project? First of all, you've got to have alignment of intention. You've got to be aiming in the same direction. So if your goals aren't the same, then it's going to be very difficult to trust. But even deeper than that, trust is a whole series of questions. It's things like, can I trust you to put together a good plan? Can I trust you to execute the plan? Can I trust you to hire the right team? Can I trust you to communicate in an open and transparent way? Can I trust you to come to me when there's a problem? Can I trust you with my money? And on and on and on. And if any one of those is missing, it almost doesn't work. So it's a much deeper psychological contract that's built up over time. You know, this is not a get-rich-quick scheme. This is a process of nurturing relationships and building trust. And when you have that trust, decisions happen very quickly. When you hear your funding partner say, well, I don't know, we still have more due diligence to do, there's a clue that maybe the trust isn't there fully. Might be they don't trust you fully, or maybe they don't trust the process that you've gone through fully. But when trust is there, things happen very quickly.
How do you build trust?
It's really over time. It's making commitments, even small commitments, and meeting them. It's, you know, when you say, here's our due diligence process, here are a list of questions, would you like to augment the list? Or happy for you to be involved as deeply as you like? Or do you just want to review the report when it's done? So you really assume responsibility for the whole process. One, you know, think about it. When you run across people that make excuses, we tend not to trust them. So don't make excuses. If you screwed up, own it. Say, I screwed up. That builds trust.
Right.
If you find a mistake that's in the other party's favor, tell them about it. Tell them you found a mistake, even if it's in their favor. You know, relationships are built on a win-win basis. Never win-lose, even if I'm on the winning side. I still don't want to do win-lose deals, even if I'm going to win.
It's part of that trust admitting, hey, I'm new to this. You know, this is going to be my first deal. Is that a hindrance? Do you find?
That can be a hindrance. Absolutely can be a hindrance. And that really gets into the third element, which is results. What's your track record? Because that's a big part of trust, and it's, in fact, so important that I broke it out as a separate element. That's really element number three. And you might be saying, well, if I'm just new and I don't have a track record, how am I going to raise any money? How am I going to, you know, get a track record if I can't raise any money? It's a catch-22. I'm stuck.
Right.
But the thing is, this is not like your grade 3 math test where if you're looking on your neighbor's sheet, you're cheating. Business is a team sport. So if you need to develop that track record, then maybe do a project with someone who's much more experienced. Maybe partner with someone who has a track record. Now, and you don't have to do this for years. You could do it for 6 months or a year. Now you're legitimately gaining a track record because you've earned it. You've worked with someone who's much more experienced. And maybe you keep them on as an advisor past that point in time. So they're, you know, virtually part of your team. That's vitally important because the more savvy investors know that it's never going to turn out exactly the way you planned it. There's always going to be something that's going to turn up that's going to be some kind of surprise. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, every project I do has some surprise in it, some nuance. Even two buildings across the street from each other on the same, like on the same street that should be identical carbon copies of each other, even there's a surprise somewhere. Right?
Yeah, it could be something as simple as a property we had this week. We had the power company giving us a delay and just setting the power pole. Well, the whole house, you know, the whole house is rehab, ready to go to put a tenant in there. You know, it's all done. And we can't put the tenant in there because we can't turn the electricity on because we're waiting on the power company to drop the pole and run the line. And then we can, then the tenant can move in. It's like, you know, that's not common, but it happens. And these variables pop up from time to time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we had a project where we dug a foundation hole and found a private sewer line crossing the backyard. It was undocumented. We went to the water department. They said, we don't know anything about this. Don't tell us. We said, what?
Wow.
They said, yeah, you can do whatever you want. Just don't tell us. He said, you mean we can cap it? They said, yep. And it was a live sewer line. Now, fortunately, we spent the extra $3,500 and connected into the sanitary sewer at the street. But you know, you never know.
That's crazy. You can find an errant sewer line into the house. I was talking to a buddy of mine, Alex Youngblood, who's a pretty big real estate investor. We were at a conference together, and he said, I'll never make this mistake again. He said, we thought that in this project, the sewer line had been run, and that everything was already run to the property. Turns out it was 300 yards away, and it had not been. So it was a $100,000 fix for them to run the lines to the property. Wow. And he was sweating it every moment, of course, because now that was his entire profit. So,
of course.
Yeah. So number three results. All right. Number four of the elements of raising money.
Number four is you've got to have a compelling opportunity. And this is where, you know, working with mentors, working with folks that are really successful in real estate, is vital, because what's compelling to you might not be compelling to somebody else. It's a little bit like saying, is that image on the magazine cover beautiful? Well, that's a little bit in the eye of the beholder. So, you know, the number of times I've heard someone say, well, I had a great deal, but I couldn't get it funded. Well, there's a clue in that, because in my experience, if it's a really great deal, it's going to get done. It's not a question of will it get done or not. It's a question is who's going to do it. Is it you or me or the next guy? But if it's really a compelling opportunity, it'll get done. Now, maybe you're looking for the money in the wrong place and you can't fund it for that reason. But often what you think is compelling in the eyes of the money may not be compelling. And so you really want to pay very close attention to that. So for me, I always look for projects where I can generate a minimum of 30% net profit. That's after everything in every single project. I won't even look at it unless, at least in my initial pro forma, I can generate a 30% net profit. Some people are out there doing deals for 10 and 15%. I think they're nuts, because, you know, you can have something go wrong and now 15% becomes 5. You can have a second thing go wrong and now you're negative.
Right, on a flip. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, it's so true. I mean, you can see it all the time. I mean, just in the state of New Jersey, I mean, I don't do flips, you know, that's not my game. But, you know, in the state of New Jersey, I mean, you know, taxes, holding, can't get permits. They're dragging their feet at the county level for permitting. Now the money that you borrow is being eaten into. Holding costs and all of those things just eat that 30% down to 15, down to 10 really quickly.
Absolutely. And you know, we don't do flips much anymore either. We occasionally do them if they're really compelling, but rarely. Most of what we do is we build new apartment buildings. And so, you know, our goal, again, part of that 30%, let's say the appraised value of the finished product might be at, let's say, $2 million, might be a 10-unit building. I want to cap my investment at, say, $1.4 million, which is 70% of $2 million. So now I've got $600,000 of equity in that. And now I can refinance the project at 70% loan to value and recoup all of my invested cash. Now I'm left with a project where I have no cash tied up in it and still 30% equity, which is a safe equity ratio. And that's my 30%. Even there, I can exit a project in a relatively short time period, even if it's a long-term hold.
This is some high-level stuff here, guys. I hope everyone's paying attention to this and go back and re-listen to this, because for a lot of people who want to take things to the next level, or they're just thinking about getting started, you know, I mean, I say really drill into your niche, too, and find out what you're comfortable doing and become educated on it, because there's so many different directions you can go. Certainly in real estate, whether it's, you know, residential buy and hold, commercial, fix and flip, want to build new apartment buildings, you've got to know your numbers and you've got to know what you're doing. In order to, prove a compelling opportunity. So many new investors I hear, whether it's wholesalers or otherwise, will start and they wonder why their cash buyers are just not calling them on a deal that they've emailed out to everyone.
Right.
Because it's not a deal. It's not a compelling deal.
Exactly.
And very often new investors will try to massage it to try to make it into a deal, right? They'll justify certain things. They become emotionally attached to it. And at the end of the day, it's just simply not a deal. Otherwise, you'd have buyers and investors calling you if it's a compelling deal.
I'll share with your listeners a trick that we use. And I call this strategy buy on the line, move the line. So what is the line? Imagine And this situation exists in virtually every major city in America. You've got a really hot neighborhood that's been gentrified. You know, it's got lots of coffee shops and art galleries and all that kind of stuff. And you go one block too far and you're in the hood. You can picture this. I know everybody can. It's all over the place. Oftentimes, that boundary is arbitrary. Now, if it's a municipal boundary or if it's a school district, you may not be able to move that line. But if it's an arbitrary boundary, you can often get tremendous value simply by buying just on the wrong side of that line. You can buy land. You can buy existing properties for pennies on the dollar, redevelop them to bring up, essentially expand the gentrified neighborhood. And now the line's on the other side of your property. So you get the comps, you get the value of the expensive neighborhood, and you get to buy at the price of the inexpensive neighborhood. And that's where you can get a tremendous amount of value creation.
That's great. So we just wrapped up number four. Let's talk about number five, the fifth element.
The fifth is what I call alignment. And this is making sure that the goals for the money and the goals for the project come together. And this is a basket of different criteria. For example, what's the size of the investment? If you need $200,000 and your investor only has $20,000, it's not going to fit. What's the term of the investment? How long is the money going to be tied up for? Some people like to turn their money every 6 months. Other people want to have it at work for 5 years. So you've got to make sure you've got alignment on the term of the investment. What's the rate of return? What is the tax consequence? What's the structure? All of these types of things, there's about 8 or 10 of them that they all need to work. Now, the more sophisticated investors are going to be much more rigid on what their investment criteria are. And so it's often not enough to have, you know, 7 out of 10 or 8 out of 10. You actually have to hit on all of them with the more sophisticated investors. And when you do, then it's, like I said, it's effortless. It's sometimes seductive when you have something that looks like it almost fits, because something that almost works actually doesn't. And that's when you get into the realm of trying to force it. And again, don't force it.
I love that. As we wrap things up here, Victor, I'd love to hear, what sort of terms do you look for? Someone's maybe structuring a real estate deal. They want to buy a 10-unit apartment complex. They're looking to do that deal. What advice would you give people for terms and how to structure things?
Oh, I'll tell you what we do. So, for example, we offer typically two types of participation. One is a straight debt participation. This might sit above the construction lender, so that's often what's called mezzanine money or a second mortgage. Sometimes it's not a recorded loan, and that's just for a premium rate of interest. So if the bank is lending me money at, say, 4.5, I might offer that lender, say, 10. And that's usually used for the construction float. Now, again, that money is going to be returned when we refinance the building when it's completed. The second is for more of a pure equity play. And what we typically do there is we offer people a small preferred interest rate, might be 5 or 6%. And then we offer them, while their money is tied up, and then we offer them an equity position. By giving them a combination of both equity and interest, we can often negotiate a lower equity share so that we, as the sponsor of the deal, end up with a higher percentage ownership of the project, and it still delivers a great rate of return for the investor because they're going to continue to make money on it for a long period of time after they've got their capital back for the life of the building. So we often do that kind of a combination structure with a small interest rate and an equity position.
Bottom line this for us, somebody wants to get started, wants to start taking action. What advice do you have for them to just get out there and get started?
I would talk to other developers. Don't try and be a hero and invent a new strategy that's never been tried. Look and see what's successful in the area. Real estate is a hyper-local business. Don't just go after things that are inexpensive. Often they're inexpensive for a reason. What you want to do is you want to make sure that the economic fundamentals are there. There's influx of jobs. I know you've talked about this many, many times. You want that influx of population, influx of jobs, and in particular, high paying jobs. When you have those ingredients, then it's very easy to justify the investment. So that'd be number one. And then just talk to other developers, hang out with other folks, other investors that are already successful in that local market. most of the time, it's not like you're going to have one or two people that have a lock on the market. There's more than enough to go around for everybody. So just copy what is already successful. Don't reinvent it.
Right. I love that. I totally agree. There's no such thing as competition. If you think abundantly, then it's amazing what abundance can come into your life. When you start trying to hold on to money and be greedy, it's amazing what doors start shutting in your face, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Victor, this has been fantastic. I want to encourage everyone to pick up the book and give us the title of the book again. We're going to link it up on our show notes page.
It's called Magnetic Capital, and it's not yet published on Amazon. We're going to be launching in June. You can purchase it in the meantime from my personal website at victorjm.com. That's victorjm.com. And happy to share with you, you know, what I know. Happy to interact with your listeners, and I think they'll get a lot out of it.
Well, perfect. Well, I believe this episode will be airing in early July, so the book should be live on Amazon as we, even though it hasn't been hit yet while we're recording this, by the time this is published and edited, it'll be out there so the world can go and grab it and buy it. So I want to encourage our entire audience to go there and download it, buy the book, and check it out. So you can dive deeper into the five elements of raising money for real estate. I know this will be incredibly invaluable for our audience. Victor, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure. And lots of fun.
Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for downloading and subscribing. We really appreciate it. And thanks again for your kind five-star reviews in the iTunes store. It means the world to us. So we publish Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We'll be back again on Monday with another episode of Investing in Real Estate. Now go out there, take action, and become a real estate investor, everyone. Have a great one. Much love.